Romeinje, 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 Romeinje.
You're listening to Shtetl on the Shortwave on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Tamara Kramer. And Shtetl is a Yiddish word for the small towns of Eastern Europe where the Jews once lived. Shtetl on the Shortwave is a show about Jewish arts and culture in Montreal.
Dort zu wohnen ist vergnügen, wo's du's Herz lässt, dir du's kennst, die kriegen.
Amma liegele,
Appa stramale,
a kernazele,
in a gläsele wein.
Welcome to Shtetl for our first show in March and what appears to be spring. So far, it appears to be spring. And today, we're very excited to have puppeteer, circus performer, musician, stilt walker, and overall femme extraordinaire, Jenny Romain. She's in Montreal from New York and doing a puppet show at the Montreal Puppet Theater Festival at Théâtre Outremont. She's going to tell us a little bit about that later with her company, Great Small Works. And Romain has committed over two decades to the cultivation of new Yiddish theater and community-based performance art. And she's with us live in the studio at CKUT. We'll be back with Jenny Romain, but first, here's a little Yiddish dub to get us into the mood with King Django. So we'll be back in a couple of minutes with Jenny Romain.
Schon kenn ich von Geräten.
All right, so we're back in the studio with Jenny Romaine, and that was Gerechnisht by King Django off of his CD Roots and Culture. He's very big in producing dub, and he does a lot of stuff in Jamaica, and he tours all over doing dub, and he, a couple of years ago, got asked if he wanted to do some Yiddish reggae and Yiddish dub, and so he's produced two CDs of Yiddish dub, and he's really, really fun to see performing. He's quite the funny guy, and he's been on Shtetl before. So he's told me he might come to Montreal at some point in the near future. So maybe we'll have him live in the studio sometime soon. So Jenny Romaine, welcome to Shtetl on the Shortwave.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you just got into Montreal last night?
Yeah.
You're here for a puppet theater festival at the Théâtre Outremont. What's happening at the festival?
There are puppet theaters from all over the world. And it's a great assortment of stuff. The section of the program that we're doing is paper theater or toy theater, which is a Victorian parlor form that we started working in maybe 20 years ago. We had been designing in a big opera house, and in New York or the United States, the arts economy is pretty messed up. So it was not very likely that we'd be designing another opera scale production anytime soon with that kind of budget. So, but we were like, wow, we started designing on this level. We don't want to stop. And we knew of this Victorian form because one of the things our company does is explore old image-based theater forms.
Okay.
We're puppeteers. We have this huge, long historical legacy of forms to choose from. And they're so inspiring and they give you all these aesthetic ideas, blah, blah, blah. So we knew about toy theater, which is really takes this Renaissance invention of the proscenium arch, which we all take for granted, but it's this marvelous framing device. And
the proscenium arch is that?
The proscenium arch. That's the thing around the theater that is that frame. And very often there's a curtain,
the
a drawn drape that's behind
okay.
it. And
uh-huh.
then when the curtain opens, that frame is called the proscenium arch. It's the edge of the stage.
Okay.
And in the 19th century, when print technology was being developed, some artists figured out, wow, if we go to the theater of our day, which is really equestrian drama and sort of large-scale expressive things where you'd blow up the mill in the third act, it was spectacle-based, not psychological. The artists would sit in the front row and they would draw pictures of the actors and the scenery. Then they would print them in a mass-produced way, and you'd go to a shop that was like a video store. You know, you could get nuts to crack and things like that, and you would buy your paper theater, and then you would bring it home, color it in, cut it out, tinsel it up, because there were armies and soldiers and everything, and then you'd set it up in your living room, and you'd have a truncated version of the script, you know, whatever, let's say you were doing The Miller and His Men, you'd have the truncated script of that, Sister Sue would read that, the dog would look on, there would be candles, you know, your brothers and sisters would do the puppets, and you'd perform the show, big spectacle show, in a reduced form in your living room or your parlor.
Wow.
Well, we learned about this form and we thought, we could really get into this. So we started doing photo montage shows.
Okay.
And we were interested in remixing the news. It was during the first Gulf War, the first time we invaded Iraq, the United States invaded Iraq.
Okay.
And we were just getting this like monstrous news feed. And this was at a time when people read newspapers. And we were, many, many people were reading the same urban newspapers. I'm from New York City, and that's where our company is. And, for example, the New York Times, we were getting the same pictorial story and weird sort of uber myth about the evil wild man who was taking over, and it was bizarre. So we thought, we really want to make our own newsreels and remix this imagery and push back. I mean, we were involved in all kinds of other political demonstrations, but this was a way as artists we could really look at this legacy of photomontage, because there's a wonderful political history of photomontage,
okay.
and then make it move. So we created this thing called the Toy Theater of Terror as Usual. And this was before terror had this kind of TM or insanity attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an idea that we're always sort of in a state of emergency, and how do we want to interpret it and deal with it?
Mm-hmm.
And so we started making these photo montage newsreels. Anyway, we then learned that there's a real long tradition of toy theater and people who still practice it. We met them, blah, blah. What you'll see at the theater if you come on Saturday are some amazing examples of this toy theater form. It's become something of a toy theater revival movement, and we host these giant festivals in New York. It's like a thing. And people now say, oh, we do toy theater, as if it's a form. It's amazing how well it caught on. So Saturday night, you'll see a beautiful show called A Walk in the City, which is an interpretation of an Italo Calvino.
Wow.
Some Italo Calvino stories. And another one called Definitely Maybe, which is a Russian sci-fi.
Okay.
Written by the Strugatsky brothers in the 70s in the USSR.
Okay.
And short entertaining history of toy theater. And this amazing woman from Los Angeles named Laura Height, who does these very sexy toy theaters and matchboxes.
So how big are these toy theaters? How do people see this from the stage?
Well, we'll have some enlargement, video enlargement, but it actually is an intimate form.
Okay.
So it's kind of great when people sit close. But as you know, the theater's big, but we have a really cool setup in the balcony, actually. So the stage faces the seats in the balcony. It's really nice.
Okay. Well, it sounds beautiful. Actually, it's kind of inspiring, the thought of instead of watching the movies that are in the theater now, instead of bringing them home on our video and playing them on our DVDs, like acting them out at home instead. Imagine.
Yeah.
So that's what people did. They would go see a play, and if they couldn't go see it, they would perform it themselves at home with these toy theaters.
Yeah.
Much more interactive.
Or make up your own.
Or
and that's what we're kind of into, like make up your own movie.
Okay. Okay.
So it's cool.
And your company is called Great Small Works.
Yes.
Which kind of makes sense based on what you were just describing.
Because sometimes we do work with 3,000 people in it, and sometimes we do work. It's so small it could be on your kitchen table. So Great Small Works, hence the name. But it's a collective, 6-member collective.
And one of the members of the collective is Mark Sussman, right? And he's a professor here at Concordia in the
yes.
theater department.
Yes.
So is he going to be also performing, doing a puppeteer in the play tomorrow night?
He'll be a puppeteer, and we do a lot of live sound mixing.
Okay.
So he'll also be doing that. And yeah, he'll be everywhere on the stage. But in that puppeteer kind of way. It was very on the DL.
But like the puppeteers for these toy theaters, is it just, are you using a finger or are are there strings?
Because it's
all small scale.
It's small scale, but you use all the techniques of grand stagecraft. That's what's so cool about it. Like we have a full fly system.
Fly system?
Video projection. And it's also, it's puppet theater, so it's all about tricks and gimmicks.
Okay.
So in every scene, there's eye candy. Like, something has to make your eyes go, wooga, 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 or we're not doing our job.
Okay.
So there's meaning, and there's beautiful stage pictures and live mixed sound. It's very rich.
Okay, great. I look forward to seeing it.
Can
I come
like
tomorrow night? Is there any, like, tickets left for the shows?
I bet there are. It's a big theater, but you might want to get them soon, because it's like, it is an intimate forum, so there's probably seats for 100, but worth it.
Okay, cool. Théâtre Outremont. Check it out. You can go to their website, I'm sure, or just Google it, Théâtre Outremont, and all the information is on there. I don't have the exact site for the festival, but all the information is on the Théâtre Outremont website, and I'm sure there's a lot of people from all over the world doing different types of puppet theater, so people might be interested in checking that out.
Yeah, I heard there's a really great Punch and Judy show from Paris, like top-notch, if you're into that kind of thing.
Okay, all right. And as part of Great Small Works, you also do some Yiddish theater? Is that true? Am I getting that right?
Yes. As part of Great Small Works, but also as kind of my own work. I don't want to drag them into it. I don't want to implicate them in everything I do.
Okay.
But I would say that I bring the Great Small Works aesthetic to everything I do, which is a lot of us met at a theater called the Bread and Puppet Theater, which is in northern Vermont. Mm-hmm. And the person who runs that theater is a sculptor, really, because he's a puppeteer and a puppet builder. But his approach is completely avant-garde and folk-based and politically engaged. So I grew up as a young person around these wild artists who would like gather 4,000 people on the side of a hill to watch a medieval-style pageant that was all about the landscape and the workings of his imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that something can be that weird and that populist and that there's no tension between prismatic work, what I would call prismatic work, which is like in the United States, I don't know how it is here, there's a very limited idea of what's possible. Even though people, when they watch the capitalist media, they're seeing incredible imagery all the time. And when they watch music videos, you know, they're seeing all this surrealism and this fantastically experimental postmodern aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And they can accept it there because it's wrapped in this wrapper of people trying to sell you something. But when you see it in a theater, I find that a lot of people get really nervous. They're like, I don't get what this means. So they're telling me I'm dumb. Or, you know, there isn't this comfort with the not knowing. With this dude, Peter Schumann,
mm-hmm.
and it was a totally intergenerational community,
mm-hmm.
and I would say they're anarchists.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine like a rurally based people who are like growing their own food, making this insane theater on the scale I've never seen before, and a great artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like not a bad painter, an amazing painter,
mm-hmm.
and an amazing sculptor. So All the artists there are multidisciplinary because puppetry is a multidisciplinary art form. Mm-hmm. Dance, music, sculpture, language, all playing the equal role. Mm-hmm. So it's not dramatic theater, which is based on the text. Mm-hmm. And just like generations of folks working together sometimes, sometimes separated by your age cohort, just producing this like very socially engaged abstract work mm-hmm. in a landscape. So I learned there, like, of course you can have... I'll give you an example in terms of the Yiddish work.
Okay. Did you do Yiddish stuff at Bread and Puppet?
Well, Bread and Puppet's a Christian environment, even though they're, I wouldn't call them religious. Peter is addressing the legacy of art in Christianity because he really redresses the European canon, I would say, of okay. art. So there's a lot of investigation of puppet theater forms within the Christian European tradition. So processional things. And mm-hmm. it's all super animist and... You know, puppet theater, what's so great about it, the way I see it, is like this tradition of dramatic theater and directing and stuff, it's very young mm-hmm. compared to puppet theater, mm-hmm. which is international. So if you think about the theater traditions of Africa and how they engage the audience and how they're connected to many, many things in a society, the Euro-American or North American tradition of people talking like this and a director telling them what to do, very small. In terms of this other kind of theater, which includes poetry, movement, improvisation. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's this huge other body of kind of expressive theatrical work that I think represents a lot of us. Mm-hmm. And the dramatic tradition represents some of us. But I know that when I go to see a play, I like it. But when I go to make work, I wouldn't make that.
Right.
Because my experience isn't expressed that way.
Right. So puppet theater
so
is
with,
a little
with the
bit
puppet
more
theater, I sort of was like, wow. It wasn't just that it was democratic. It really suited my experience of reality.
Okay.
And so that's the kind of work I make. Mm-hmm. So I didn't make Yiddish work there, although there was a strong feeling of Ashkenaz there because Peter is from Germany. So there was something very, like, I could feel Ashkenaz. There was something familiar, like, from my family.
Okay.
I grew up in a Yiddish-speaking milieu. My people are from the Ukraine. And I'm a native listener. Everyone around me was speaking Yiddish, and I was listening okay. to it. And I went to Yiddish school
wow.
as a kid. I didn't go to Hebrew school, and I never went to a synagogue ever until I was an adult. And I chose to go there. So our religion, our Jewish practice had to do with trade unionism, like okay. an engagement in political stuff. Mm-hmm. And then this Yiddishist thing, which is a lot of music and literature and thinking politically. I mean, okay. I remember as a kid, they would bring us in a room and we'd talk about apartheid in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Like, that was Yiddish school that day.
Wow.
So I always understood that somehow to be a Jew was to be engaged in larger discussions of marginality and power and who ends up on the – what side of it and what you can do to make justice happen. And it was very communal. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't a God at the center of it. However – all my grandparents came from a religious thing. So, you know, they would say, we will now not say a Shekhianu. You know, they would knew what they weren't doing.
Okay.
They had made some choices. Like, my grandfather was in Odessa when the Potemkin came in.
Okay.
And he was working in a tea factory. Marginalized shtetl dude working in a tea factory. Part of all these workers' revolts. So I grew up around people who had seen the tipping point happen. Mm-hmm. Like, they had been in these revolutionary moments where they felt something much bigger than they ever could have imagined happening. Mm-hmm. And I think that was transmitted to me.
Okay.
So I feel that is possible.
Okay. So for you, your connection to Judaism and Jewish culture is really a cultural connection, and it's a political connection, less so than a spiritual one? Or
well,
one
I wouldn't say that. I call that all that stuff extremely spiritual. Okay. But I didn't get into the other tradition, the religious tradition and those texts until it seems to be like you can maintain a secular identity like that if you have a knowledge of the traditional stuff too. Like, I never could maintain such a strong identity. I guess you'd call it secular mm-hmm. If I didn't have knowledge of the other stuff. So as a younger person, I was the mentee of this amazing scholar named Dr. Barbara Kirschenblatt Gimblett, who taught this, you know, a folklore class at a school I attended where they had a performance studies department, New York University. And there I met her, and she was like, she just, the aesthetics of everyday life became something I understood, folklore, blah, blah, blah. She ended up getting me a job at the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research, which is the Yiddischer Wissenschaftlicher Institut YIVO. which was founded in Vilna, Poland, it was then Poland, in the late 20s, by radical socialists,
okay,
who they are diasporists, and they were committed to figuring out how Jews could survive in Poland, economically disenfranchised. Mm-hmm. They saw that on the power side of the equation, the Jews had this amazing culture. Every melody, every kahila, every newspaper, every traditional practice was on the plus side of their power economy. And they were trying to figure out, how can we stay in Poland? You know, dort wo my leben, dort ist unser Land. Where we live, that's our homeland. They're like, how can we figure out how to live as an ethnic disenfranchised, ethnic despised minority here and make it work? We have all this stuff. What can we do? And a lot of people at that time were moving to, they were getting into the Zionist alternative, or they were just assimilating, or they were leaving because the economy was farblunget, was gone.
Okay.
Hose, lost. So their idea was, we're going to build an archive. They also saw it changing. Modernity was coming to the Jewish world kind of later than everybody else, you know, like, but that's okay. The Jews were in the enchanted world where, like, you know, everything was accompanied by a melody or a thought about, you know, incredible folklore, incredible, you know, traditional learning practices, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
Farming, prostitutes, thieves, it was all there.
Okay.
It was all live. It was all happening. So they set out. They did projects with youth where they had youth write autobiographies, and they had huge contests because Max Weinreich, one of the theorizers of this socialist Deutschkeit Hirnis movement, was like, people in the process of becoming, der Weg zu unserer Jugend, like, what is the way into our youth? How can we figure out these people who are, like, in the middle of this messed up situation? How can we empower them? First, we have to know who they are, and we have to let them know that who they are is important to us.
Mm-hmm.
Autobiography contests. So these incredible stories of what people are enduring. It's like a complete mess. You know, there's no money. There's war going on. People are displaced. There's disease. There's education. You know, all the things that go along with poverty, basically, and mm-hmm. this minority experience. They also went out to all the shtetlach, and they said, sing me every melody you know. And they recorded it. They went and they took all the record books from the Jewish communities of who, you know, Hasidic communities. These are people who are socialists. But they saw that in every aspect of religious life and traditional life and the food ways and you name it, there was information to be transmitted. And this was a cultural power bank. And they wanted to develop it and say, like, it's going to be through the rearrangements of these fragments that we create something new. It's a postmodern idea. It's really... Mm-hmm. Pretty intense. Like, whenever I hear people talk about the Black Panthers,
mm-hmm.
I think of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, the Black Arts Movement or any of these people that are saying, like, we know it's not a continuous identity. It's not like, my mother did it this way and I'm going to do it this way. It's about montage. It's like,
right.
We're going to rearrange it and it's going to explode. And something
this was all
towards
the aim of staying in Poland and maintaining their cultural identity there as a minority?
Yeah. It's okay. A diasporic, a very strong diasporic stance.
And this was the beginning of the YIVO Institute, this yeah. archive of all this material.
And so now, I'm sorry I'm going on about YIVO, but I just think it's so cool.
No, it's interesting. It's important to hear about it.
Those folks, of course, were destroyed. But they during the Nazi occupation, they would sneak out and bury things under the sidewalks of the ghetto. Some of them made it out, and of course, after the war, when all the books and the resources got shipped to the U.S., everybody wept when they opened the boxes because, like, all the stuff was there, but the people were not. So it was like this, you know, terrible tragedy. However, I was lucky enough to work there at a time when there were still a lot of Europeans alive. So it was interesting. I lived in interwar Poland for a bunch of years, so I experienced the vibrancy of that culture and its political diversity and its religious diversity, like, in full living color.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a nostalgic feeling about it.
Okay.
It feels very real to me, and I feel like that's one of – I feel blessed by that because it's not about, like, oh, my Bubba's kochleffel, you know, my grandmother's cooking spoon. It's not like that. It's more like –
There's
you know,
so much exciting stuff happening.
Well, who were the avant-garde Yiddish puppeteers in Vilna? And what were they dealing with artistically and formally?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, in terms of the art, I feel very connected to this montage theory of history. And I feel like that montage theory of history is how I make art. So, like, we're sitting here with Katie, who works with Josh Dolgan. And I feel like, you know, the local so-called dude that you probably all love, his Yiddish art. But I feel connected to that art in terms of the layering, like what he's doing sonically and mixing contemporary stuff with archival stuff very freely. When I first started hearing Josh's work, I was like, because I was a sound archivist at Evo. So for 13 years, I listened to the recordings that he's mixing. Okay. So when he's mixing, I'm like, whoa. Like, for me, it was like this unbelievable experience of someone like, as if you were totally familiar with a library. And then somebody started like reading pages from different books at the same time and then stacking them up. And but, you know, it was like an incredible experience. So I feel akin to that if people are familiar with that work.
Awesome. And people are very familiar. I think people who listen to Shtetl and the Shortwave probably know Josh Dolgan, and that does give us an idea of what you're talking about. Like, it's a dialogue between what happened then, what's happening now, how they connect, and it's very meaningful and very informative. I would, maybe we can, like, maybe one day you can do, like, a live tour of the YIVO archive for the Shtetl listeners. I think it would be really fascinating. But we got to take a quick break, and we're going to be back. We'll hear a bit of music, and then we'll be back with Jenny Romain on Shtetl on the Shortwave. So thanks for tuning in. We'll be back in a couple of seconds.
Er hat sich Shtetl auf den Shortwave auf CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Flying high like eagles do, climbing up, climbing up. heads were banging on the lamentation. Walu, 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 walu. Lamentation, walu, 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 walu. Lamentation, walu, 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 walu. Lamentation, walu.
So that was Lamentation Walu by Boogie Balagan. They're a group that are out of France, but they're both, well, they call themselves Palest Israelians. They're both from Israel, Palestine, and they live in France and write about the potential for the two worlds to come together and what could have been and what could be for friendship between Arabs, Jews, Palestinians, Israelis. And they've been on Shtetl before and have a lot of really interesting things to say about it. This week is Israel Apartheid Week, and we're hearing all about it all around us, and there are a lot of events happening in Montreal that you can find out about by just Googling that. As well, there are other events that are showcasing what is happening in Israel from another point of view. There's the Real Israel Festival, and that's a film festival which is highlighting Tel Aviv filmmakers. It's happening at the Corona Theater on March 11th, so you can just Google that, Real, R-E-E-L, Israel Festival. And also there's the Montreal Dialogue Group. You can check out what's happening with them at dialoguegroup.org, and it's a place where Jews and Arabs and Palestinians and people of all types of different ways of thinking and political stripes come together to discuss these issues. They have a lot of events coming up in the coming months, including a human rights Passover Seder and many other ones that are geared towards coming at this question from a safe space of dialogue. So I hope you'll check that out. And we're back with Jenny Romaine, who has a hell of a lot of information to give over. And so I've got to choose my questions carefully so that I get everything in, which of course we won't, but maybe
not. I just want to tell you tomorrow, I have the Jewish skill of talking and listening at the same time. So you could ask and I could talk at the same time. I'm just saying, if it comes to that, we can double time it.
I feel like I've had a lot of practice at that at my family dinners, just people totally talking over each other. And apparently they are listening to each other.
Yeah.
But I maybe we can try that. Let's try it. Okay. We'll see what happens. But I want to start by asking you a couple of things. You say that you've directed community-based spectacles for Jews for racial and economic justice. What is that organization all about, and what were the spectacles like?
Well, huge question. JFRJ, or Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, was founded in New York City about 20 years ago. And what was happening was, you know, this Jewish milieu, Sviva environment I had described earlier, of people being politically progressive, that's how I grew up. It's like the Jews that I met were the people who were in the anti-Vietnam War coalition and had been engaged with the civil rights movement and understood that progressive struggles were somehow tied up with their own liberation and safety as diasporic people, whatever. And then as the sort of Reagan agenda grew in the United States and the Jews' class climbed, they started to become more conservative. And there was this wave of people, the neoconservatives, who started speaking for all of us. And we're like, I don't think so. And so when Nelson Mandela was freed from jail, the response from the organized Jewish community in New York City was, he hugged Arafat. We will not acknowledge what this is or what it means. And a lot of us were like, I don't think so. I think if Nelson Mandela is coming to New York, and this is a milestone in the dismantlement of apartheid, like, it's a huge achievement. It's a gigantic world moment of possibility. We want to celebrate that, and we want to toast that, and you don't speak for us. And so this organization was founded, big tent, all kinds of Jews, but everyone with this real commitment to being part of struggles for justice, economic justice, racial justice in New York City. So wonderful people are in the organization, and we do all kinds of interesting campaign work. And then the cultural work, I would say two examples was I did a youth theater workshop for many years, which were young people, Jewish young people who live in Brooklyn. And they lived right on the borders of these brown people with brown skin neighborhoods, whether they were American blacks or Caribbeans or Dominicans. Anyway, they're these neighborhoods that were segregated. And we sort of felt like, we're just geographically segregated. We're segregated for structural reasons, but it needn't be this way. And there were different campaigns in the city that were dealing with issues of affordable housing and stuff that really needed communal collaboration in order to work. So we were hired by these political organizations, me and these young pugs that I was working with, adorable high school students, who wanted to do theater and also wanted to be engaged and meet each other. Like, you know, the kids from Prospect Heights High School wanted to know the kids from the other side of the park. Like, they see each other all the time. Like, everybody wants – no one wants the segregation. Mm-hmm. So this was an opportunity to make art, which, as we all know, is hard. And it's really like a political campaign. Like, you have to make it happen and there's a deadline. So it's so not abstract. Like, if you have to make a show, it's work. You have to do it. It's not like an endless conversation. You got to get something done.
You got to produce something.
So we did a combination of sort of – workshops that helped us study the content we were contracted to represent in our shows. So in other words, we would have people come in giving lectures about the prison industrial complex and images of people who were formerly incarcerated coming back into the community. You know, like we got briefings. We got political briefings. But, you know, in a nice peer education kind of way. So it was suitable for the young people. We did theater training. And then we made these hysterical shows that I would say refer back to that other stuff I was talking about like the folk Dada. Like the total comfort with the open, funny, populist theater that deals with political stuff that's totally aesthetically awesome in its design. So here, the bread and puppet model feeds this work. And so we made these gorgeous shows and we would go into these communities that were totally fraught. Like a lot of this stuff we were hired to talk about was around public education and justice around demography because kids who were in certain kinds of communities were having less money put into their educations than kids from wealthier communities. And what it meant was, according to the law, if you get a sound basic education, you should be able to get out of poverty. But if you are not delivered that service, your rights are being violated
right.
by the state. So there was a big court case around that, and we took that on. It was called the Campaign for Fiscal Equity.
So the young people who were part of this spectacle were from both sides of this?
Directly affected people.
And so some were young Jewish people?
Yeah.
And
the white people in the group were Jewish.
Okay.
And so it was a very – we didn't necessarily talk about religious issues in that, but we definitely talked about who is who and ethnicity. But in this kind of way, like – in our culture, the stuff you're not allowed to say.
Like what?
Just like where society thinks you belong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you do a sort of human grid about, you know, where you'd like to be in terms of Donald Trump rich or indigent poor, where would you like to be? And then, you know, you make this stage picture. And then where does society think you belong? And like all the brown people walk to one side of the stage and the other kids. The workshop was about understanding what structural reality we're in mm-hmm. and then how we want to deal with it. But in a totally playful way.
Okay.
So we would go into these community meetings where the people from the up the hill side of town wanted to build a school for the poor kids on a brown site, which is like a chemical dump, former right. chemical dump, because they didn't want the kids from the lower sourced school coming to their school because it would bring the academic levels down because the kids hadn't had the top-notch prep that the up the hill kids had had, blah, blah. So we go into this meeting and we do this totally, I would say, entertaining, funny, and quite honest politically show that proposed alternatives or like how people might work together. And the community was like, they were in the room, these people who are supposed to hate each other, they're laughing their butts off mm-hmm. and realizing like, oh man, they're talking about this straight up. Mm-hmm. And so the theater was great. Like we would go to these totally fraught, uptight meetings where everyone's nervous and do this really amazing show with a lot of style and playfulness. And it really helped. So that was a cool context in which to make art. And then another thing that Jayfridge does are these amazing Purim spielen, which we've been doing for a bunch of years. And those are giant masquerade balls, at the center of which is the Book of Esther, mm-hmm. which wears the mask of being this historical text. But it's really sort of a burlesque of a story about how powerful people will ultimately bring about their own downfall and act mm-hmm. really dumb. And how this whole metaphor about revenge, the endless story of like they were going to kill us, so we had to kill them. And we often, you know, play with that kind of thing. But anyway, it's a retelling of the Purim story. And like 400 people come and it's very, very queer, multi-generational. It's like the party of the year. And okay. it's sort of known as like the big – and that often too is with all the Jayfridge ally groups. Because Jayfridge also does very serious – I mean, not serious, like there's always the fun, playful attitude, but it's politically serious and strategic work.
Is there a large divide, do you feel, like in New York City where you're from, between the Jewish people who are doing this type of art and practicing their Jewish culture in this type of way and Jews who are not politically active? Can they come together? Are there the Jews who are religious, cultural Jews who are interested in going to synagogue and being part of this – just spiritual life completely divorced from political activism, and then the others, and they don't necessarily meet? Or is there a meeting place?
Well, I think that one thing beautiful about the Yiddish, about Yiddish land, is that, to harken back to the discussion of YIVO and the programs that came out of that, like Klez Camp, the Yiddish Folk Arts Program, Klez Canada.
Where you've taught, right?
Where I've taught both. I started the youth theater program at Klez Camp, and I've done different kinds of workshops at Klez Canada. There needn't be a separation, because there are people who want justice and want to be part of that, and their Jewishness propels them to do that kind of work in every community.
Right.
So I see it as like, as an organizer of that, I want to be reaching out to everybody and make an environment where everyone can be comfortable there.
And, is that possible?
Yeah. And I think it takes an experience of having that big tent, and that's why the YIVO thing is so important and Klez Camp is so important. People who've never had the big tent may not know that, like, their ortho, you know, the Hasidic secretary, Shandel, is actually extremely progressive. Mm-hmm. She's Lubavitch, but she's talking to me. And that, like, when we have a union struggle at the work site, the religious people and the left-wing people are on the same planet, because the religious people recognize, like, oh, my God, there is such a power greater than capitalism. Like, hello? Mm-hmm. Making sure that kids – because we don't have socialized health care. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our workplace disputes are about, like, the weakest members of our society getting care. So, like, the religious people have a lot of kids. So they need health care for their children.
Right.
So for them, it's very clear, like, we're talking about health care for kids. And for the left-wing people, they're like, we're talking about health care for children. You know, so there's – they're very, I found that to be a very fruitful engagement, and it's very, very precious. What's challenging for me is I hadn't met, because I'm not from a fundamentalist background, I hadn't met, like, the religious people that I was meeting, the very religious people, were very open-minded and progressive. So I never, I'm not to say that we shared politics, I just felt like they were open to, like, wanting to make art and explore identity in a big way, big tent way. They were not exclusive. Then I started to meet the more heavy fundamentalist people who – the basic difference is, like, I can look at a fundamentalist or someone who practices a very strict Jewish lifestyle and say, wow, that's what gives your life meaning. Rock on. It's beautiful how you do that, how you maintain your traditions and da-da-da. This is how I do it. But they can't – when I find the walls, when they can't look back and say, that's how you do it. That's cool.
Right.
And so I have encountered some of that, and that's been really challenging, traumatizing, I would say.
Okay. Traumatizing.
Yeah, because when I met some of the more right-wing closed, I had never had the expectation that just because you were a traditional Jew that you would be closed-minded or mean, mm-hmm. in terms of difference, like of opinion or smallness of thought or range of thought, full of fear. I hadn't had that. And then I had some experiences with people like that. So I'm a little bit more leery, but I still believe it's possible. Yiddish land teaches me that it's possible.
In terms of Yiddish, seeing as we're talking about that, and you do a lot of your performances and stuff, there is a lot of Yiddish there, and that's really important to you. How does it work, considering that so many people don't speak Yiddish? How do you connect with people, and do you think that all Jewish people should learn Yiddish?
No. I don't think – first of all, Yiddish is just one of many Jewish languages, so right. You only learn Yiddish if it's useful to you. And there's a very cool thing, which is there's a core of folks who are very committed to Yiddish, and I really respect them. And I've never been able to – like, I studied the language very intensively and worked in the language and want to know it. But there's some people, they just go there and they write plays and they do shows and they do it in the language, and it's awesome, and I love to attend. I've never been able to make myself do that as an artist. There's Yiddish in what I do, or the things will be bilingual, but I've never been able to go that whole way. It's just – you know, I have to accept it. It's sort of like a limit of my practice. So I try to include it as much as possible. But and sometimes the one-to-one translation really gets on my nerves because it's a little bit infantilizing. Mm-hmm. I see it as an ongoing question to be engaged with. How can Yiddish function in this piece? So in some places, like I do this Yiddish kids show at the Folksbühne Yiddish Theater, the National Yiddish Theater of the United States, where we teach Yiddish. And so that's really great because it's totally funny. It's like Sesame Street and a variety show. It's a really good show. Kids in Yiddish, if you're in New York in December and January, it's the place to be. So some shows like really teach Yiddish, and I love to partner with people from that world. And then sometimes in my own work, there's nobody else around who speaks Yiddish, and I'm just the one delivering it. And it maybe stands out like a sore thumb, but I keep trying to bring it in.
Okay. It's so you do it in translation. You like mix it in and you explain.
Sometimes I don't translate at all. Sometimes I don't translate at all. like very often, you know, music is so much easier that way because melodic, you don't need to translate a melody.
Right.
So I always work with musicians. So there's like a huge musical way that that gets in. And yeah, sometimes I don't translate it.
Okay. There are so many things that I want to ask you about. It's unbelievable. Like, I have a huge list in front of me, and I don't know. You're going to have to come back. I hope you do, because there's so much to cover. So let's see. You taught at the Rose M. Singer High School for Girls on Rikers Island. Tell me about that. I'm really curious to know how that happened and what that experience was like. What were you teaching there? Was it theater?
Yeah. I'll tell you how it happened. I went to India with a group of street performers. I perform a lot on the street because I just got tired of these producers who weren't understanding what I was talking about. Like I said, in the United States, or even anywhere, people have trouble understanding, like, the work is abstract, it's folk-based, it's, like, totally related to Yiddish tradition or whatever. It's open work. It's not going to tell you what to think. It's just going to give you this marvelous experience of thinking, and it's going to be sexy and fun, and you're going to love it. But I felt like these producers weren't getting it. So I'm just like, I'm going direct to the consumer, because I do a street circus anyway. I'm in an outdoor traveling circus, and I know people love the work. So I'm just going direct to the consumer, performing on the street. Years of this, making spectacle for the street, trying to figure out what works. And I was recruited by this group of American, Indian, and artists from Afghanistan going to India to do a skills share with all different kinds of groups. Because in India, theater is still like mass form of media because there's so many people. And if you want to communicate information, you really can do theater. You go to a village and you can reach every day thousands of new people with information. And people need information for their health and all kinds of things. So we were doing a skills share because the artists were like, we need more skills because we have to do these street performances every day and we need help. So we did these amazing skill shares. And what I learned there was, go to the place where there's the most need. Art is one of the most profound ways to stimulate the imagination, is to begin the process of transformation and getting what you want. Mm-hmm. And I just kept seeing that over and over again. It's like the imagination is the key to personal transformation, which can lead to social transformation. It's like the power of that became apparently clear. So it's like, where is there the most need? Go there. Because what you have is very powerful. You don't need to go to... So that just resonated with me. So when I came back to the States, I thought, where do I want to work? And it's like, I want to work in jails, because that's where people need space to think about what they're doing and have a moment where they can reflect. And also, living in a country that has the highest incarceration rate in the world, I just felt like I really wanted to understand who was in jail, why they were in jail, what it was like to be in jail. You know what I mean? It's like, if your culture produces alarm clocks and you don't know anything about alarm clocks, it's like... Not to compare prison to alarm clocks, but, you know, we live in a prison culture. And I really wanted to understand that. And so I started teaching in these schools. And what was weird was that Rikers Island became a center for puppetry arts, because I think a lot of other puppeteers happened to be teaching at Rikers. So at one point I'd be like, what? And I would find out that, you know, Theodora Skipetaris was teaching there. And it turns out that one of the deans of the education programs there really believed that puppetry was the way that, like, people in jail were going to survive the experience and free their minds. Okay. How do you like them apples? Wow. So that's how we ended up in the jail.
Okay. And it was something that the girls or the women in the jail were interested in learning to do puppet theater. It really spoke to them.
Yeah. Or? I mean, I think it's good. It's good art training. So they were into it. Also, you know, they don't have that much to do when they're there. So it was very cool. And there were moments when people were like, look, this is too open-minded and I'm in this jail and I have to survive and I can't be that open. Mm-hmm. At certain points, they're like, it's helpful. When you do writing, it gets more intense because people's feelings are really going to come out and then you have to deal with those and you want to deal with those. But with the visual art stuff, we did an adaptation of an Erykah Badu song called This One's the Healer. And it was like we did music videos in handbags. We turned the handbags into toy theaters because they have such incredible architecture. And, you know, every girl loves her bag kind of thing. So we transformed these incredible handbags into these like Baroque, amazing theaters. And then we did visual adaptations of that song by Erykah Badu. And she's very, very free as an artist. And I think for some of the young women, it was like, I love this. Can't go where she's going. Okay. I can't let myself be that unguarded because I'm in a jail. And it is a very stressful place. However, it was a very successful workshop.
Great. Okay, we have to play one more ad, and then we'll be back with Jenny Romaine, and we'll close up the show, and we're going to hear a little bit of music, and don't go away. We'll be right back on Shtetl on the Shortwave.
shtetl. Oi! What is it? Shtetl what?
Shtetl in the shortwave.
Hello? Hello, Ma. Hello, Ma. It's me, Mira. Peaches. Afasakim. You're listening to Shtetl on the shortwave. Oi vey. On CIUT.
CKUT.
Oh. On CKUT. Now you have to do editing.
No, it's perfect.
Oi vey. Shtetl, oi.
That was a little bit from Peaches, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago. So that was a really fun show. And today we have with us in the studio Jenny Romaine. And I'd like to thank you, Jenny, for coming in. You're like absolutely an encyclopedia of a lot of information. There was so much that we didn't even talk about, your collaborations with Canadian Jewish artists. And I would really like to encourage people to check out all the things that Jenny has done. You can look at Great Small Works. .org, circusamuck.org, or you can just Google Jenny Romaine to find out a lot more about her Yiddish work. And most of all, I'd really like to thank Jenny for coming into the studio in her blue sequined top.
My great pleasure. It was hard to figure out what to wear on the radio, but I felt like it was successful.
You chose really well. Thank you. Thanks so much. So I've got a couple of announcements to make. And then we're going to go out with a little music. And then, of course, stay tuned for Butcher T's Noontime Cuts. Butcher T's already in the studio, and he always has great music for us. So just to let you know that this Sunday at the Jewish Public Library, there's going to be a movie called At Home in Utopia. It's at 2 o'clock on Sunday. And I'll just read you quickly a description. The film explores the lives and vision of thousands of immigrant Jewish garment workers who left the urban slums of New York to build cooperatively owned and run apartment complexes in the Bronx. The United Workers Cooperative Colony of the 1920s became known as the co-ops, a place in which individuals sought out the utopian ideals of an equitable and just society. So for information about that, you can just go to the Jewish Public Library's website, or you can give them a call, 345-2627, extension 3006. And that's this Sunday, March 7th at 2 p.m. Looks really interesting. Also, if you're into live jazz improv with a little bit of a Hasidic twist, there's Nozin, Damien Nissenson's band, and they're going to be playing at 10-11, 4115 Saint-Denis on Saturday the 13th at 8:30 p.m. Amazing. So check them out if you have a chance. Nozen at 10-11. Also, there's so much happening. It's unbelievable. I think it's the spring thing. People are really getting out there with all their events. There's a lot of stuff happening at the Siegel Center, the cinema space. And on Monday, March 15th, there's a fundraiser for Namat Canada with a screening of the award-winning feature film Arranged, about the friendship between a Muslim woman and an Orthodox Jewish woman. So for information on that, go to thesiegelcenter.org. And finally, at Aleph, Aleph is the Centre d'études juives contemporaines, and it's run by Sonia Sarah Lipsick. It's a really amazing center. They have all kinds of discussions, and this Sunday they have Femmes de la Bible, Femmes d'aujourd'hui, so about women in the Bible, and there's sort of a feeling of connection between orthodoxy and feminism. So it's from 10:30 to 2:30 p.m. Dr. Norma Joseph, Dr. Sonia Sarah Lipsick, and Barbara Nuremberg will be presenting, and it happens to be for the first time this one will be in English. So for information about that, go to csuq.org. And I know I just gave you so much information, and you're probably going to want to re-listen to the show and download it and listen to it a couple of times with Jenny Romaine, you know. So all you have to do is go to the Shtetl blog to listen. It'll be up later today, and you can write down all the information that I just rambled out. It's a WordPress blog, so it's shtetlontheshortwave.wordpress.org. And all the shows are up there, so please check it out. Thank you to Katie Moore, finally back from Vancouver from the Olympics, for teching the show today. Katie, did you have a good time?
I did.
What did you do there?
I sang.
For who?
For Feist.
Way to go. Way to make us proud here at Shtetl. So we're going to go out with one last song. It's got a kind of fun, playful, circusy feel, kind of post-Purim alcohol song by Lotta Lenya, and it's called Alabama. Thank you so much for tuning in to Shtetl on the Shortwave.
Oh, show us whiskey bar.
Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why.
For we must find the next whiskey bar. For if we don't find the next whiskey bar,
I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die.
I tell you, I tell you, I tell you we must die.